Thanks for downloading the Racing Postcast. Listen online and on mobile.
Welcome to a Racing Post Bloodstock podcast. I'm Martin Stevens. I've got here the Racing Post Bloodstock editor, Mark Scully, and our special guest this time is Alex Elliott, Bloodstock agent extraordinaire. And we're going to be talking about the yearling sales coming ahead, how Alex got into being a Bloodstock agent, his life as an agent, and some other industry issues. So we won't delay. What are you doing at this time of year then, when you've got catalogues landing on your doormat for Doncaster, Arcana and BBAG? What are you doing? How do you prepare?
Well, I'd actually quite like to be in Saratoga this week rather than flicking over catalogues. But yeah, you've got to thumb each catalogue and find out. I try and look at as many horses at each sale as possible. So I don't tend to knock too many horses off just by going through catalogues, and prefer to let the individual sort of tell me whether it's a yay or a nay at the sale.
So what research would you do, though, when you've got the catalogue page in front of you? Do you look at previous prices paid for the siblings or breeders?
I do think it's important. I think the breeder is incredibly important. The farm and the nursery where the horses come from has a huge knock-on effect. Sales prices I tend not to get too wrapped up in, because you can, if you think a horse costs 100 grand as a foal, then you might not even, you may not even look at the horse, which at the end of the day, the horse could RNA for 60 grand and you'd be able to buy him. So I don't get too wrapped up in all of that.
So that's interesting then. So some people would say, I think that a good horse could come from anywhere, but you're saying actually you would be quite, you would pinpoint a few who you think are better producers?
No, I think there's definitely, a good horse can come from anywhere, as we've seen. They come from all over, they come from every sale. They come from every country, but I just don't. I do believe that there are certain nurseries which produce better stock than others.
Yeah. Okay, so let's rewind then. How did you come to be a bloodstock agent?
It was actually all by chance, really. It wasn't really my initial career path. What I always planned on doing was training, and that's what I set out when I left school. I worked for Philip Hobbs as a groom in my gap year, and then he invited me to go back as a pupil assistant, which I did for 2 years. And then it came to a bit of a crossroads, whether he's quite friendly with Sir Mark Prescott, and there was a chance that I apply for that job, or something popped up in the paper, which my parents were quite keen for me to do, considering I hadn't been to university, and that was the Flying Start. And I applied for it, thinking that the Godolphin Flying Start, as it is now, was the Derley Flying Start. Thought I had absolutely no chance, and by some sort of miracle, got a place on that, and that was hugely beneficial. Met some wonderful people, took me all over the world, and after that I worked for Sir Michael Stout for about 8 months prior to going to the States as an assistant trainer, while I worked for Christophe Clément and then California for Owen Harty. I was there for a total of 4 years before outstaying my visa, so I couldn't, I didn't outstay them. If I had outstayed them, I'd have been in a spot of bother, but I couldn't extend my visa, so came back. And after having wanted to train for so long, it became quite apparent that I didn't really fancy being an assistant trainer back in the UK after running these strings in the States. And I applied for a job with Jamie McAlmont in 2012, who's a bloodstock consultant to the Arcos and Coolmore, etc., etc. And did 2 years with Jamie, and then nature of the beast. I was quite keen to start my own business, and I had some clients that. Some small clients that wanted to start buying a few horses through me, and rolled the die, and so I've been going since 2014, the end of 2014 I established it, so just going into my fourth year of yearling sales.
Yeah, and we'll talk some more about some of the individual horses you've bought, the good horses, but what fascinates me is you've proven you've got a good eye for a horse, you can buy them cheaply, but how on earth do you, as a bloodstock agent, find clients? How do you convince someone that you will go to a sale and spend 30, 50, 100,000 pounds of their money to buy a horse?
It is hard, and as an impetuous young person, you really want to be spending all this money, and you really want to be buying the best stock, etc., etc. I came up the racetrack side, as I just explained. I think a lot of agents come up the nomination side, the farm side, which I would advise, if anybody wants to be a bloodstock agent, do it that way, because you get to meet all the clients, you're booking their mayors, you're going to dinners and lunches with them, you're speaking to them the whole time, you're building a relationship. I just came in cold, started work as an assistant for Jamie. But where I think I had an advantage was that I'd spent so long in the track in the States and being around horses, that you just start to absorb what works and what doesn't. And I think I've aligned myself to some good trainers here and in the US, which I think is vital, because good trainers make good agents. And it's just slowly progressed from there. It's different clients through different trainers. You start to get to know them. It is a slow burner, and then eventually we'll get to the stage where we can start buying on more pedigree and better physicals, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a long game played slowly.
You mentioned, I mean, right at the top, you said about how you'd love to have been in Saratoga this weekend. You've mentioned the time you spent in the US. How important is that global understanding, and how do you market yourself? Effectively, you're a brand. How do you market your brand as a bloodstock agent globally? It's hard enough to do it just in one space, but how do you go about presenting yourself to a worldwide potential market like that?
Well, considering I did my time in the States, which if I had to speak to any young person that wanted to make a career in racing or bloodstock, the industry as a whole, I think the US is the greatest place to learn. There's such a vast expanse of everything, from the veterinarian to the way the horse. It's hard on horses. They're training left-handed on dirt the whole time. You study conformation, everything. But my problem now is, as a business model, every time I got on a plane, I go west, which isn't actually where the business is really starting to fly. If you go east, you've got Australia, you've got Asia, you've got China, which is obviously bursting onto the scene. And you've also got the Middle East. So ideally, I'd be trying to push my business the other way, but the States has been very good to me in terms of pinhooking out of Kentucky, the September sale, which I always attend. And also, it's slowed down a lot now, selling horses, fillies, to go to the States. It's obviously been fillies that just miss here, that need black type, they can go to the States, they can get it. That market has slowed down, which is another topic. But America's been very good to me, and I would just, anybody that is a young person in the industry, you've seen John Gosden, the list's endless. Yeah. The States is the place where you learn, for me.
So should we go through a few case studies then, some of the horses that you have bought, and then you can sort of explain the reasoning behind it. So I guess so far the Masterstroke has been Please Let Me Win. I know there's another one, a more recent one, but we'll come to that later. So he was bought for £36,000 from the Goffs UK Silver Sale, the supposedly less select Doncaster Yearling Sale. He won the Horace Hill Stakes, and then he was sold for 450,000 guineas to go and race in Qatar, where he's still doing very well, I think, isn't he? So how did that come about? And I assume your clients there were absolutely over the moon.
Everyone was delighted. Rafe, it was actually my... So in 2014, went on my own. 2015 was sort of my first yearling sales, and you're just trying to find something which sort of nobody else kind of wants, and it's that rough diamond type of thing. And he was a beautiful horse by Power, who was a first season stallion. Yeah. His Rafe had actually trained one of the relations, Jack Aranda Ridge, who was kind of an 80 horse, and he fell in, and actually couldn't get hold of Rafe at the time, and I went in, bid 36, rang him up, and I said I bought that Power, and he went oh. Anyway, he said, I'll call you back. And Con Marnane tried to come and buy the horse off me. And I could have sold it to Con, but if he goes breezing, is it really my horse to advertise? And yeah. Rafe ran me back and took the horse. So he was superb. And it's these horses, it's a little bit of a catch-22. He goes and brings 450 after winning a Group 3 as a two-year-old. For me, you'd like to see him knock around Europe a little bit. So it's just an easier horse to market rather than going to Qatar as an older horse. So it is a catch-22, but it was, the clients were delighted. It was good business.
And another catch-22 that's happened recently, but it's still a fantastic advertisement for you, is Nuremberg, who was £30,000, another first season sire in War Command, won very easily there at Ascot, and you say now that he's been sold to Hong Kong.
The sale is pending, money. So I don't want to bock the whole thing, but right. The sale is pending. The vetting's passed, it's bloods, etc. Yeah. But... 30,000, won very impressively at Ascot, and has been sold for astronomical figures to Hong Kong, which is great, and everyone's happy, everyone reinvests, so and that's what it's all about. But it's, as I say, you do kind of need some of these horses running for you here in Europe to really get your brand going.
Yeah.
Is the emergence of Hong Kong, obviously, as the such a powerful buyer of horses here. Obviously, it's great for owners that they can make such a return on a horse that they've invested in the first place. But is it a worry that perhaps some of our horses are shipped off to Hong Kong a little bit too early, or that we don't see enough of them here, you know, before making their way over there? Is it something that
I think it's healthy because it's ploughing money back into our market.
Yeah.
It all boils down to, we know there's so many factors in the industry that rely on prize money. It's another thing that it's just another knock-on effect of poor prize money.
Yeah.
People have to sell these horses because it just doesn't. No matter how successful you are, if you're a businessman, you've made money. To that bottom line is so important to people. And when these big numbers arrive, you do have to take them, because at the end of the day, these horses can let you down and invariably do let you down.
So another case study of a good horse you've bought, and it's more of a fun one really, Mount Moriah, who very good stayer, won the listed race this year and was third in the Irish Ledger. And he was bought in Baden-Baden, which is coming up at the end of the month. Again, very cheaply, €30,000.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Again, Rafe and I, Rafe Beckett, who's been a huge supporter of mine, is great. More of an owner breeder trainer, trained these good staying horses, did his time with Martin Pike and Peter Wallen. And he always wants to look for a horse that stays well, because the resale of these horses, it's a mile plus, is just so much better than the fast 2-year-old sprinters. I mean, once Ascot's out of the way, those horses are, if they haven't won or been placed at Ascot, they're kind of in a spot of bother. So Rafe consciously said, listen, let's go and buy a staying type of horse. And we found Mount Moriah, who was by Mount Nelson, who I love him, as he was hugely underrated, had Penn Hill and all these good horses. So he's been a good horse, and they've turned down huge money from Australia for him.
Oh, very good. And just two more horses we'll mention before going to a break. Concierge, she looks really exciting, won two of his three starts. £60,000 from the Goffs UK Premier Yearling Sale, which is only 2 weeks away now. Son of Society Rock, how did that one come to you?
Well, again, this is where we were talking about the nurseries before. I mean, Tally Ho, Tony and Roger Callahan and Henry, a wonderful, wonderful nurse. They've got Kodiak, but they've been doing it for years. Their operation is just sweet as a nut. Everything they do is. And they had Society Rock, which is a huge loss to the industry. At the end of last year, he'd had, unfortunately, by the time Donnie came around, he'd had these good sprinters. And he was a horse that I loved, a little bit small, but fell into that bracket, which I think there's going to be a huge, we'll talk about it later on, the market. There's just in that 60 grand gap, which is a lot of money for people to find, but it's maybe just off the big boys' radar. Mm. And he looks a fast horse that's going to go to the Gough sales race at York at the Ebor meeting. So, yeah, he's been good.
Good. And then lastly, one who a lot of our viewers will be a big fan of, Super Sunday. You played a part in his story.
I just got on my own, and actually thanks again to Rafe. He said Henry de Bromhead has a client looking for a horse, a good horse, maybe could go dual purpose. Mr. Potts was quite ill at the time, and unfortunately he's passed away since. So he was a cool horse. He was bought him after his listed win at Ascot. Mm-hmm. If you look at the point to point market now and the national market now, it wasn't a huge sum of money compared to what they're paying for horses that have fallen at the last in a point to point. He'd won a listed race.
Yeah.
So we bought him, and unfortunately Henry and Mr. Potts parted ways. But since he's gone to Jesse, he's transformed, and he's a wonderful horse. And that National Hunt side of my business is a business that I'd like to grow. But again, it's just finding the right horse at the right price. You've got to try and do that. And I've been lucky enough to buy a horse for Cheveley Park recently in France to go jumping. He's gone to Henry de Bromhead. Bought a horse that was listed placed for Henry again. So the jumping thing is a thing that I love. It's obviously with my background, something that I've always been quite close to. And I actually, it's quite funny, I find it easier to sell a big money jump horse than it is to sell a big money yearling, because, as you said, people have got to start to judge backing your eye before they let you spend that big money.
Okay, yeah. Well, that is crazy that Super Sunday was so not in demand in his early days. I remember I was at the Newbury sale where he was offered after he'd won his...
He was amazing. He was never... That horse was never in demand. He was a 200 grand not sold yearling. Went into training with a few flat trainers that said, this is the slowest horse you have ever seen in your life. Ended up at Doncaster Sales, where Andrew Tinkler's brother bought him for £5,000. He won a bumper for Tim Fitzgerald in Newbury.
Yeah.
didn't sell there, sold outside the ring, then went to Andrew Balding. Andrew Balding said, I don't run this thing on the flat because it's so slow. So the owners, I think it was Northern Line Racing, said, run him in this listed bumper. And he went round, he beat Yanworth by 5 lengths, yeah. And it was 25 lengths back to Thistlecrack. And then we were able to buy him. So he's been a really cool horse, and he's a nice horse to be able to
The irony is he's probably one of the best bred horses you've bought, isn't
he? And Jessie, I think, she always wanted to run him back on the flat, and Mr. Potts didn't really allow it. Yeah. And now that he's become so good jumping, she just made, I think he could run an Ascot Gold Cup and run well, but I think she just thinks that it would just, he's quite a lazy horse, might just take it out of it. He loves his jumping now, and fun.
I suppose he's the perfect example of one of the big challenges for you in your profession, which is trusting your own judgment and your own eye, as opposed to following the understood wisdom, if you like, and following the crowd, and not just being a sheep, you know, of thinking, I know what I'm looking for, I know what I want, and I think I see it. And
yeah, I mean, they don't come round very often. You've really got to be on the ball about finding them. It's very hard just to go to sales and pick the obvious horse, because if I do that once and the horse doesn't work out, then it's immediately, I mean, you can do it numerous times. If you're buying for big companies, for these big companies, these big firms, you're buying lots of these big money horses, and one pops up, then everything's good. But if you go with me and you fire the one big bullet and it doesn't work out, it doesn't look good. So you've got to really, it's just about slowly building up this reputation of buying the right horse at the right price.
Right, we'll be back after a break to speak about the coming yearling sales, what we think the market will be like for season size, we like the look of, and so on.
Thanks for downloading the Racing Postcast. Listen online and on mobile.
Welcome back to the second part of our Bloodstock podcast. I'm Martin Stevens, still have Mark Scully, the Bloodstock editor here, and Bloodstock agent Alex Elliott. So now we're going to talk about the yearling sales, because we have on the horizon Doncaster, we have Arcana and BBAG coming up very soon. What are our expectations of the market, Alex? I'm thinking there's definitely a note of, if not negativity, caution in the air, because the Breeze Up sales didn't go quite so well this year, and that might raise worries about people reinvesting. We also have a huge number of new sires going on the market this year, including all those sort of Dali club sires. What are you thinking going into the season?
Well, since there's nobody knocking at my door with tens of millions to spend, then I'm a little bit cautious about the whole thing. I think everyone's a little bit nervous, especially after the Breeze Up sales, which was a bloodbath in general. I think, as in with life in general, everybody now is, they want perfection. They want everything. And if you don't have perfection, it's just not quite good enough. And it is it's extremely expensive to have a horse in training in Europe. You're not, the prize money, I hate to bang on about it, it is the number one factor as to why all this is happening, as well as overproduction. But to have a horse that costs £15,000, or to have a horse that costs £150,000, costs exactly the same to have this horse in training. So why, and you're going to be racing for the same prize money, so it's just very hard for these people to compete. I mean, I take my hat off to Mark Johnston, he's just the most unbelievable operator, to be able, because I say you can't buy a horse for £15,000 and it'd be good, but as we've seen with Mark, he does it time and time again. His system works for him in terms of buying and training these horses. But I think it's a worry, the overproduction and the fact that these guys got burnt at the Breeze Ups and they're not going to be reinvesting. But I think there's also going to be huge opportunity. The 50 to the 150 bracket is, as I've said, it might not be good enough for the top guys. So there's going to be huge chances for people that want to race, find good horses in that price range. I think there's going to be a huge opportunity, and I'm looking forward to the challenge of finding them.
So what do we think then, that the top part of the market might be unaffected because that's insulated by the Maktoum and Coolmore and Qatari investment and so on?
Yeah, exactly. I think we see it time and time again. We'll go to Arcana and it'll be gangbusters. We saw in Saratoga last night, there's $1 million for American farriers going around. The whole world's great. But wait till we start getting into the book twos and the book threes or the silver sale, and it's going to be patchy, and it's just the way the business has gone, I'm afraid.
Yeah. But as you say, then there are opportunities there, you think.
And yeah, if you work hard enough, and if, I mean, people ring me up and they say, how come that wasn't on a list, or that was then? It wasn't on a list because at that time we didn't have that order to find that type of horse. Or it's like anything, it's a window of opportunity that you have to hit when you're buying a horse, and you might not have the right order to buy the horse that you want.
And it's the great paradox of overproduction, isn't it? We can sit and evangelise about how certain mares shouldn't be bred from, but time and time again, some of these mares who could have been discarded for very little money end up producing the good horses.
Yeah, they come from anywhere.
Yeah,
you've just got to be on the ball, and you've got to have enough faith in your conviction that when you see something, you've got to go ahead. Like, I've bought a numerous amount of horses on spec, which isn't a nice feeling because you've got to try and get them sold. And it's just, especially when you're saying, listen, I just believe that this is the right one.
Yeah.
But as I said, no, it's going to be it's challenging times for the industry. But I think a challenge is always good.
And do you ever think then, I mean, you said that you don't really obey the catalogue page that much, but are you looking for any sort of ins and thinking a new sire might be cheaper, or conversely, an established sire who people may have gone off of because of fashions have changed but are still very adept at producing good horses? Do you zone in on those?
Yeah, well, I've always been, because I've worked with horses for so long and looked at horses for so long, I'm a big man for the physical.
Right.
The physical has to come first. Whereas Mark Johnston will go through his catalogue, and if there isn't black type in that first dam, he doesn't want to know about it.
So would anything on a page put you off?
First foals out of unraced dams are kind of a...
Yeah.
Especially, I mean, there's just too much guesswork involved in it. I mean, there might have been a good reason why the mare was unraced, so if you find that out, then
yeah.
it's using all the intelligence that you've collected over so long and picking certain spots. But no, I generally like to be open-minded, and if I love a physical, that is the main thing to me, because I think if a horse looks like it can't run, but if it's got a great pedigree, I'm not taking that risk. I can't send that back to a trainer.
No.
Or I've got to send something that's aesthetically pleasing to everybody back, and then when these horses do become good, they've got big resale.
Yeah.
If you've got a horse that is crooked but can run, and you haven't paid that much money for it, and somebody comes to buy it, then they're going to go, sorry, I can't really, that doesn't really work for me. So Mark's in a very, he's in a great position. He trains his own horses, he knows what works, he knows what he can get away with, whereas for me, I have to be a little bit more understanding of the whole picture.
Okay, so this probably isn't a very good lead-in then, if you're saying that you don't actually take too much consideration of pedigree. But I was going to ask about which new sires this year you're looking forward to. So in the top bracket, we have the sort of three who stand out: Glen Eagles, Golden Horn and Mahara. And then we have a real rash this year of those sort of cheaper, more precocious stallions like Angel, Brazen Bow, Cable Bay, Due Diligence, Gitaifan, Hot Streak, Ivorwood and Outstrip. And then you have sort of a couple who would fit into the middle, maybe really good, well-bred classic winners like Make Believe and Knight of Thunder. So out of all that lot, who are your pick for the top?
Well, for me, it's going to be, I thought this last year, and I was actually lucky enough to buy the most expensive Australia filly that went to auction. I gave $400,000 for her. She's gone to Michael Bell. She hasn't run yet. Australia's obviously a slow burner. He had Broom last week in Galway that won well, but he is going to be a slow burner. I think if there's a good-looking Golden Horn or a good-looking Muhara or there's a good-looking Glen Eagles, then I'm going to be getting nowhere near it. So I've got to try and change the sights a little bit, unless I get a one-off that I can buy like I did last year. The filly, I think they've all obviously got outstanding chances. They were great racehorses with good pedigrees that are going to get good mares. They're going to have good chances. I like Cable Bay as a faster type of horse. He might not have been the most correct, but he was a fast horse. I'll be very, very open-minded. I believe all these horses are retired to stud because they had a reason to be retired to stud. And I don't really tend to get too drawn into letting that put me off buying one of them or not. So, okay. Yeah.
Well, that spoilt that bit about the new size then, really.
No, listen, I like Make Believe. I thought he was a beautiful horse.
Yeah.
McVie maybe hasn't done quite... He's not a Galileo or...
No.
He's not an Oasis Dream like Muhara. But McVie, Make Believe was a very, very good horse trained by Andre Fab. And I think, as I say, Cable Bay, Make Believe, Gutafan, they made huge prices, these horses, he's the son of Dark Angel, made huge prices as foals. They were very good models. He's a horse I'd like to try and look into buying maybe one or two of those. But I think I'm just very open-minded as to how it all plays out.
Okay, well, putting the issue on its head then, are there any slightly older stallions who have been good to you over the years who you would, again, you don't go by pedigree, but you might look at the catalogue page after you've looked at the physique and thought, oh yeah, he's, you know, been a good stallion, and who's maybe been slightly left behind by fashion? Are there any stallions like that?
Yeah, I mean, this time last year, we were all walking around the sales going, oh, that Oasis Dream, he's not really getting it done, is he? And then he's got the second top-rated two-year-old, who's a filly in Pretty Pollyanna this year. Yeah. And he had Muhura just before that. So, no, I don't. The industry is just so fickle and everything is just so sexy that stallions do get forks put in them very early. There's a horse like Power. If there was enough of those going around, I'd be mad to buy one or two of them because he's been good to me with Please Let Me Win, and they can all get it done. So I'd be open to any of them really.
Yeah, well, that's very good to hear really, that you're not sort of subscribing to that, because to be frank, a lot of agents will be sort of thought of harshly because a lot of you do subscribe to fashion and will fall
well,
in
it's
and
just
love.
It's about what you can, as an agent, a lot of the time, I hope I don't fall into that, but it's about what you can sell.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's been numerous times where trainers have gone, I'd like to buy that because it's by this stallion, it's got a bit of pedigree, and I take it back to my open day and I can sell it because the guys don't know what they're looking at, these owners. Whereas to me, it's more, hold on, we've got to try and get the racehorse. But sometimes the racehorse, does it, like my auntie is a great example of it, Jill Richardson.
Yes.
She brought numerous amounts of cheap horses that have gone. She bought Music Show for 16,000 in Gorsebridge that won the Falmouth. I mean, the list is endless. And I think it's important not to get sucked into that if you're going to sustain your career.
Yeah. So tell us about your itinerary then for the few weeks, months ahead.
So next Wednesday, I'll drive over to Arcana, which is it's a boutique sale. It's very hard to buy the horses that you really want, but you've got to do your due diligence and go. And then
The V2 sale has really come through, hasn't it now?
The V2 sale's done really well. I bought a horse there last year, a beautiful horse, by a reliable man out of a street cry mare, which I absolutely adore. I gave €85,000 for him. Sorry, this wasn't the V2, this was the October sale.
The October sale, yes.
Yeah. And he's a horse called Master Brewer that's with Michael Ballon. Could have probably won the Winkfield at Ascot the other day with a bit of luck. But no, the V2's come to life. A lot of the pinhookers like that.
Yes.
And then I go to Doncaster, which has been which I think is a wonderful sale. Then I get on a flight to Baden-Baden, which has been lucky for me. Then Keeneland, then back. We go to Goffs, then we go to Tattersalls, and then we go back to Arcana for the October sale.
Yes, to find another.
And then we're into the horses and training and so on.
Yeah. So that would sound very glamorous, and you can understand why a lot of young people want to be a bloodstock agent, but I assume it's not quite as high-flying and jet-setting as it sounds.
Listen, it's a wonderful way of life. If you can make it pay, it is a wonderful way of life. But if I put to you that you have a 100,000 order for Arcana, which €100,000 or pound order is it's a big order. You've got to get yourself to Arcana. Mm-hmm. You've got to pay for yourself for however many days. You might have to employ somebody to do it. Luckily in Arcana, they ensure that you're paid as an agent. If you sign the ticket, the buyer has to pay the sales company, and they then give you the 5%. Whereas a lot of clients don't want to give you 5%.
Right. Yeah.
So by the time, so say you buy the horse for 100,000, you get paid 5,000. By the time you've got yourself there, you've stayed in Deauville for a week, which is very expensive, as we all know. Yeah. You've socialised. You've paid somebody to help you look at horses. You then maybe had a few horses vetted that another client won't pay for, so you end up paying for that. There's not a lot of juice at the end of the week. So it is glamorous, and it is a great way of life if you can make it pay, but it's not all quite as straightforward as people think it is.
Right. Any other questions in this part before we?
I thought it was interesting to touch on Germany, because that is not necessarily somewhere people would think about, but it's clearly, you know, you've mentioned a few times, it's come up here in this conversation, it's clearly somewhere that you take very seriously and see as a real opportunity.
Well, the Germans have a certain criteria of standing horses, whether it's how many runs and which greatest takes performer, and there's certain health requirements like horse kind of bled, etc., etc. So they breed fundamentally a very strong, sound horse. Mm. And bringing horses back to England and Ireland, you can find good dual purpose horses. So if you get a horse that's rated 80 or 85 and he's by Maxios or Son of Monson. Mm-hmm. But by the time he comes a three-year-old, he might be rated 80 or 85, which is perfectly good. But he's got huge resale to the jumping guys. And if he isn't quite, if he's kind of a little bit too good for the jumping guys, you've got the Australians coming in. So it's if you've got the patience, which is a hard thing to have in this game, because as soon as you buy a horse, time is money. If you have the patience and the foresight, like the train and the style of training, like the trainer I buy for, Michael Bell, Rafe Beckett, then that lends itself to buying those type of horses, and there's huge value because people in this day and age aren't quite as patient as they probably once were.
I mean, the German racing scene just seems to be maybe just struggling a little bit at the moment. You don't see as many of, for example, in the German Derby last few years, there haven't really been British and Irish horses going over there.
Yeah.
There's some you know, financial issues around German racing at the moment as well in terms of the market. How is it to participate in that market? How's the competition there, for example, on the top prospects there in the yearling sales?
The competition is strong. Like, you saw Godolphin come in last year and they gave, I think, $500,000 for a See the Moon, who won the German Derby, and he produced some beautiful horses, and I think he's going to have every chance as a stallion. It's a relatively small insular country when it comes to its racing, and we saw, was it Ben Battle went and picked up their Group 1.
Right.
These horses, when they do go, they do expose some of the horses that are kept there. Mm. But I think in terms of buying horses out and their racing as a whole, I think it's fairly solid.
Good. Okay, we'll be back after another break, and we'll be back talking about wider industry issues, first season sires we've been impressed by, and so forth.
Thanks for downloading the Racing Postcast. Listen online and on mobile.
Okay, welcome back to the third part of this Racing Post Bloodstock podcast. Martin Stevens here with Mark Scully, the Bloodstock editor, and Alex Elliott, Bloodstock agent. So we touched on a few issues there in the first two segments, which we're going to go back on now. The first one is getting people, first of all, into ownership. We said there that prize money is dire and sort of is a big obstacle to getting people in and retaining people in horse racing. What can we do? Are there issues like syndication that can be explored further?
I definitely think syndication. We've been reading recently, Jack Cantillon wrote something very apt recently about syndication. Myself and George Scott and another agent called Billy Jackson Stobbs were looking to the yearling sales, and we've created a syndicate called the Black Dragon just to try and make things a little bit cheaper. Because as I say, you buy a horse for X or Y, it costs the same to keep it in training. So if you can try and limit those costs while the horse is in training, it gives you a better chance. And it's also fun to have horses with other people. We have the best product in the world without prize money or whatever. And that means that every other nation wants a piece of, we've got the best bloodstock and we've got the best product. And they want pieces of that. And if they keep wanting that, we're always going to make money selling horses. Mm. And if we can bring people into it with a view as a syndicate, where you can it should be all about having a good time, and we can sort of, if we can make the bottom line work a bit more by selling these horses, and we can have these syndicates where people can and enjoy it, then I think it's beneficial.
It seems to me though that it is quite no disrespect to what you've just said, there is an awful lot of cheap talk about syndication. People say, oh, we must have more syndicates, and people have been saying that now for 2, 3, 4 years. That's not new, but we don't seem to get to the point like it is in Australia, where there's the famous statistic about 1 in 200-something people owning a racehorse. Why don't we get there? What's holding back?
Maybe it's quite a hard industry to relate to. Maybe it's seen as a real hierarchy, and it is a sport of kings. Maybe that's why it's hard to sell it to the man on the street. Football's a much easier product to sell. People can go to football, people can play football. People can't do that in racing. People can go and bet, they can go and drink, they can go and socialise. But it's maybe just a little bit aloof, let's say. Mm. And I think it is getting better with time. I think it is getting better. But I think the closer we can bring that to people, and maybe syndication, as you said, people. But Midland Park have done extremely
yeah.
well. Highclere have done extremely well. Chelsea Thoroughbreds have started to extremely well. It is starting to become more and more apparent. it's a hard thing to get off the ground. It's a hard thing. The cost of the horses and the cost of keeping them versus what you can win is very hard to explain to people.
That's the difference, isn't it? I mean, Australia, it works so well because if you have a horse in New South Wales, you're racing on a, if it's racing on a Saturday or a Wednesday at the Metropolitan meetings, from September the 1st, every single Metropolitan race in Sydney that's run on a Saturday is worth $125,000. Yeah. So if you've got a horse going around in those races, then you've got more than a fighting chance of not only making your money back, but you know, paying. You place in one of those races one time in the year, you know, you probably covered your costs for
and
the year.
And it's so hard to get a good horse here because you've got to compete against Galileo, you've got to compete against Dubawi, you've got to compete against the top echelon of the sport to be good at it, to be any good at it. And I think that's very hard for people to get their heads around.
Hmm. Yeah. And as we mentioned earlier, it's hard when you're trying to attract clients that for these business people who will have the money to spend, who have been very successful in their business, you're trying to introduce them to a sport and an industry where they're going to have to be introduced to losing.
Of course, yeah. I mean, these successful businessmen, they're winners, and they're stepping into a sport where, on a good day, you're losing 80% of the time. Now, that's not easy to do. You take your wife racing and you're losing 80% of the time. I mean, you're not going to feel like a superstar, are you? So the education is the hardest thing, to get them educated as to what the racing involves. Because you just see so many of these people come in and then leave. I think the education of it is vital. But yeah, that 80% isn't ideal, is it?
No.
How exactly. Do you cope with that personally?
I'm not good. As I said, I always wanted to train. And I think I'd be a good trainer, but I don't think my mind, because I get very up and down. I tell you, when these horses get beat very personally, and I get fairly euphoric when they work out. So it's it isn't easy.
Is training still on the horizon somewhere?
I don't know. We'll see somewhere. I mean, it is a real burning passion.
Really, yeah.
And but I think the bloodstock, as you said, it is a great way of life. It's a better way of life than training horses, but it's probably not quite as satisfying as training horses.
Mm. I've been thinking about other issues that have been in the news. I know you wanted to ask about a controversial list that was published.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose the list has served its purpose for the publishers because if they'd taken out a full-page advert in the Racing Post, they probably wouldn't have had as many people talking about them as they have done by publishing this list. But still, it got a lot of people talking. This Fitzdares 35... At 35, it wasn't under 35, wasn't it? It was inclusive. But a lot of people, I think it touched the nerve with a lot of people because it seemed to reflect a feeling that racing is all about, well, that it's nepotistic, that there aren't pathways for young people who aren't from families with money and families with heritage in the game to reach the upper echelons. I mean, you've spoken about your journey through racing, of working your way, getting onto the flying start and so on. But do you think we have a problem as an industry with it being something that talented young people would look at and think, it's not for me because I can't get in?
Well, I think it, I mean, the industry has a lot to do with connections, and it's a lot to do with who you know, and it's a lot to do it's a lot to do with who you know. But that said, it's an amazing industry because if you're prepared to get in and work as hard as you can, doors will open. And you'll be able to carve out a great career for yourself. I mean, there's numerous different people that weren't on that list that have. I mean, the list of those people is endless. I think it's very hard to get to the top of the tree, which is a bit frustrating for a lot of people, because no matter how hard you work, if you can't get to the top of the tree, that's just like bashing your head against the wall. But you can get yourself to a certain level, and then, as I said, if you stand the test of time. I think you'll get there eventually, but it's there's a lot of opportunity in the industry, and I think it's easy to stand back and say, "Oh, it's not who you are and where you're from." It's all about who you are and where you're from. But I think a bit of hard work will take you a long way.
And how far do you see yourself? What targets do you set yourself as a bloodstock agent? Are there races that you want to buy the winners of? Is there a certain price threshold that you want to spend at a sale? Or what? How do you deem success and where you
want to be? I deem success for myself. If I ever... I buy horses across the board. As I said, I bought one for 400,000, which is crazy money, and then I buy a horse for 5,000. From the moment I buy that horse, if that ever increases in value, I've done my job. Mm-hmm. Whether it goes up to 1 million and the owner decides not to sell and then it's worth zero the next week, that's not my problem. If I'd advise them not to sell, then it is my problem. But I get great satisfaction as if a horse's value ever increases, mm-hmm. I've done my job. And that's the way I run my business. And it's the only way I can do it. Because when you're buying 30, 40 grand horses, the chances are they're going to be, hopefully, 80, 85 horses. Mm. So, and if they exceed that, then it's all good and well. And seeing owners with a big smile on their face after winning races, there isn't a lot that really beats that.
So where do you want to take the business then? Is the next step that you want to increase volume of horses you buy? Is it?
Oh, I'd love to be leading by at all these sales. I'd love to have the next Mr. King Power knocking on the door. I mean, that is, of course, I mean, I think everybody has a certain type of ego, and I think everybody, especially in racing, has a bit of an ego. You want to be as good as you can, and that means really buying the most expensive horses that then go on to become Group 1 winners. And the most expensive horses are the best horses for a reason, because they give you the biggest chance of getting that end goal. So I think I just got to keep going as it is going, and hopefully if you keep knocking on the door, then eventually it opens.
Mm. So Wax, we'll see you in Deauville next week then.
I look forward to it.
Many thanks for coming in for the podcast. It's been a blast. Any other questions before we wrap up?
Fantastic place to end, I think, and look ahead to the yearling sale, and hopefully some success with what comes from there.
And then maybe next year you'll come back in for another podcast, and we'll talk about your successful purchases from this year's sales. So
I'd love to. Thank you very much.
And goodbye.
Thanks for downloading the Racing Postcast. Listen online and on mobile.